So it just sort of struck me this, the end bit there, defeat our Babel with your Pentecost. Looking ahead to June in Bible month, we'll be looking at the book of Genesis. And one of the things that we looked at the worship leaders and preachers meeting this week was some examples from Genesis and how they might be used to inform us and learn from during Bible month. And one of the things that was chosen was the story of Babel. And was it a worship of buildings or was it a celebration of diversity? But we know with Pentecost, God's Spirit's there with us for us all to make sense and understand each other. And the turning of tables is very much about our relationships with God. Letting every day, perhaps, be a Pentecost. My granddaughter is a brownie, which is a rainbow, and then she was a brownie. And she said, I'm going to make my brownie promise. And she told me all about her brownie promise, and I started saying it with her. And she said, Grandma, you've got the words wrong. It's different. And then I got her to say it again, and I thought, it is different. When I was a brownie, it was, I promised to do my best, to do my duty to God and the Queen, to help other people and to keep the brownie law. And now, there's a lot of you reciting that along with me then. And now, I promise to do my best, to be true to my values. And I thought, that's a huge thing for a 7, 8, 9-year-old to understand. I mean, duty to God and duty to the Queen at that time was also pretty big, but you could sort of hold it in some sort of way because you went to church and Sunday school and you knew what the Queen was about, but holding on to values, you know, where do those values come from? How are they formed? Do they change with life's experiences? Do they change as we learn, or we just stick to what we've always done because that's what we always know, and that's what we feel safe with. And the churning of the tables is certainly not a place to be safe in. It also brought to mind a little bit about, you know, being true to your values. It also brought to mind my school motto, put on the front of our school prayer books. Beyond the best, there is a better. I always struggled to get more than 8 out of 10 in tests. I then gave up because, you know, what's better than 10 out of 10? But no, everybody does their best and everybody can be stretched and challenged. I think that's where that particular motto came from. But sometimes it does challenge you to sort of stop and think about some of these phrases that we come out with. What do they really mean in the way we live our lives? Perhaps our first reading that we'll hear from Exodus offers us some sort of framework for a rule-based living. And then our second reading perhaps understands and gives that framework a zeal for life, a zeal for practice. We'll try to link those two together afterwards. So our first reading, Exodus 20, 1 to 17.
Some of the hardest rules ever to follow, aren't they? The Ten Commandments. And God spake all these words. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above, or the earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labour and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them. But he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honour your father and your mother, so that you may live long in the land of the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false witness against your neighbour. You shall not covet your neighbour's house. You shall not covet your neighbour's wife, or his male or female servants, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbour. Amen.
And the second reading is from John 2, 13 to 22.
The Passover of the Jews was near, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple he found people selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and the money changers. They were seated at their tables. Making a whip of cords, he drove all of them out of the temple with the sheep and the cattle. He also poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. He told those who were selling the doves, "Take these things out of here. Stop making my father's house a marketplace." His disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." The Jews then said to him, "What sign can you show us for doing this?" Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." The Jews then said, "This temple has been under construction for 46 years, and you will raise it up in 3 days." But he was speaking of the temple of his body. After he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scripture and the word that Jesus had spoken. Thanks be to God for the reading of his word.
Connection between first and second readings, that love. But ways of showing love, so change. Whips to drive out cattle and tables overturned and money scattered, with a contrast to what we are given to think about today. Pure, spotless, let us be. I wonder what spots in our lives create barriers to other people, barriers for our relationships with each other, barriers for our relationship with God. And how do we feel when we read about Jesus's righteous anger? Is there such a thing? Or was it just a spot of temple cleansing because it was getting a bit mucky with all those animals? I think it was bigger than that, don't you? I've often thought about that image when I've gone to different churches and visited different places over the years. Some places you go in and there's a table for donations and there's some cards to be bought and there's some gifts to memorabilia to take away, and then you might get into the worship space. In some of the bigger places, you're stopped from going in before you've paid an entrance fee. And in other places, you might have enjoyed the space and the calm, but the only way out is through the gift shop where you're being directed to buy more stuff. Don't get me wrong, it's okay in some ways because these buildings do need some income to be able to keep them up. But sometimes, does that money, does that gift get in the way of worship? A few years ago, I was helping at an event at St Paul's Cathedral in London. We were down in the crypt in the meeting gathering rooms. And afterwards, I went up to the main sanctuary area to clear away some boxes. And it was just, wow. The lights had gone down and gone off. People had gone. And the only thing that was just lit was the altar in the middle. And it was just an immense dark space with that light shining in the darkness. And this stillness, after all the hustle and bustle of our event, I just stood there and somebody came looking for me. Are you all right? Yeah, I'm a lot better now than I was before. This moment of peace and calm. So in some ways, perhaps it wasn't... No, it was okay for Jesus to get cross with all these money changers and all this equipment and everything else that's making noise in that temple bit. But it wasn't until I started looking through the connectional materials for today and the discussion group sort of highlighted a couple of things for me that I'd not noticed beforehand. The temple cleansing happened in the outer court. Not in the main bit of the temple, it was in the outer court. So, yeah, it was in that entrance gathering area. But it was that outer court that everybody was allowed to use. Only the more important people could go and use the inner court. Some sort of separation of Jews and Gentiles in a temple that was built to worship God, in a space that was created for all people to worship God. So perhaps there was some sort of anger at the systemic injustices against the marginalised people who'd already been divided out as different. That although they'd been allocated this quieter outer temple area, other people had appropriated that space and it was no longer fit for purpose for quiet worship or for building up a relationship with God. The market traders got very focused on their protocols. You need some turtle doves, you need an animal, you need to make this sacrifice, you need to, oh, can only pay in special temple money, so you've got to change your money here. And so it went on. Human things got in the way of that space to worship and be in. A boundary to God's love. And God wasn't going to tolerate that. So Jesus came in and overturned the tables that were creating a barrier to God. But then you start thinking, there was this conversation that came and followed that afterwards. The Jewish leaders demanded an explanation. Was it criminal damage? But in that conversation, other boundaries were revealed. In response to, well, tell us why you're doing this, this is not right. Jesus says, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. And the authorities grumbled and said, 3 days, 46 years, and we're still building bits of this. You know, their focus was on the human achievement. Their focus was on the building and the construction. Bit like that Tower of Babel, a boundary that prevents people recognizing Jesus as the Messiah, Jesus as the living temple. Without recognizing God and without that quietness of that space to worship and build a relationship, another boundary was created. A boundary in the individuals of not recognizing that they too were temples of God. Because as we accept God into our lives, we become part of that living temple. A personal relationship with God is not possible if there isn't that space for flourishing in that relationship. Pure and spotless, let us be. and God cares passionately about righting injustices. We are transformed by God's saving grace. And one sign of this is our response to partner God in that work of liberation, freedom for all. We've had little bits of that freedom and the boundaries that have wrapped us with the sweet papers and the shrouds and things that we've looked at in the previous 2 weeks. I wonder what injustices make you most angry. Not being served first when you've been standing there queuing for ages? Or maybe something a bit bigger. Racism, poverty, climate crisis, people trafficking. And the list will go on and on. The world is not fair. It's not as it should be or could be. And it was just really nice on Friday here when we were sharing the World Day of Prayer services, and there were some really beautiful and challenging insights into some very huge unfairnesses that are going on in the world. The World Day of Prayer focused on the injustices in Palestine. And through the stories of Palestinian women, three different generations were giving witness to years of war and conflict, witness to the truth of experiences of art and culture and human life. Witnesses to persistence, witnesses to alternative ways of being together. One of the women's stories, a lady called Sarah, said, "I am nourished by the love of my ancestors. I can bear with others in love because they did. Their love makes me flourish like the leaf on an olive tree." And there again is that connection between the two, the Exodus rules for living, all based on love. And Jesus' anger, that love being pulled apart and misused. I'm often being curious as to why the turning of the tables is in John's Gospel appears at the beginning of the Gospel, and in all the other Gospels it comes at the end. It comes at the end at Passover time and leading up to Passover and the events of Good Friday. But in John's Gospel, it's there right at the beginning. And it's almost like, well, Jesus wasn't just there in Jerusalem for the Passover that very last year of his life. Surely he'd been to Passover. And we know he did when he was 12, didn't he? He went up and went to the temple to celebrate. So what was John doing putting that story there at the beginning? And some commentators sort of think it's because of John's style of writing. He picks on the stories, on the dialogue. It's the things that Jesus says and the interrelationships between people that are important to John. Not just the narratives and the history and the chronological order. Lack of recognition and being misunderstood in the temple sets the scene for Jesus' ministry in many ways. He's always out there looking at the marginalized, looking at the people on the edges. God loved all the world. Jesus loved all the world, and he wanted everybody to come and see that love in him as the living temple. He could see that people were being exploited, and he did something different. He offered an alternative. And God's bias is towards people experiencing poverty and being excluded, and Jesus showed us how to do that. On Friday, I was walking the York City walls as part of the global alternative to the Palestinian marathon. As I walked around the walls, I found myself peering through people's windows and wondering about their lives and what they did. Like, oh no, I'm not going to be nosy, but you know, you get drawn into these spaces or a plant or something of a different colour that's there. And I wondered what it was like to be inside that room looking out at the city walls and watching all these people staring in. But also whether those walls were a shelter or a shade, depending where the sun was in relationship to the flats. And then I realised that in Bethlehem, the separation wall is built into the houses. It's built in the middle of the streets. It's built, there is no window through it. There is no easy access as there is in the city walls through bars and gates. In York, you can come and go through those gateways. You can go shopping, you can travel, you can meet people. In Jerusalem, in Bethlehem, you can't go beyond the front door sometimes because of the checkpoints and the soldiers. There is restriction to movement within communities and between communities. So what walls do we create in our relationships with others? How do we challenge our own biases? God promises a different future. A future where everyone has enough to eat and a good quality of life. A place where there's sufficient support through hard times, no need for food banks and clothes banks and warm hubs. A community where we can all wake up in the morning with hope and opportunities and options to make a fulfilled life. So I was a little surprised this week as well that Amnesty International UK have just launched a new campaign. It's called Before Our Eyes. Has anybody come across that? Anybody heard about it? I mean, Amnesty does human rights elsewhere, doesn't it? It doesn't do human rights here. But Human Rights UK is challenging the violations on human rights that are happening in this country today. Millions of families can't access what they need to live. They haven't got suitable housing or access to healthcare. They haven't got access to food or education. And those rights to access, to raise a voice, are being eroded. And this is the crisis that we're told is due to cost of living, lack of resources. But is it? Amnesty consider that the crisis is due to political choices that favour inequality and a devastating lack of respect for others. The UK in 1976 signed up to the International Covenant in Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. Those rights are not protected in law in this country. So whether it's Amnesty or a lawyer or somebody claiming their rights to access to healthcare, rights to education, right to cost of living, fair wages, it is not easy to get justice in the law courts because there is no legal protection for that. And we do still need to shout about those human rights because they continue to be eroded. And dare you say it, more so since Brexit. In the Methodist way of life, the challenge commitment reminds us that God is the liberator. God's always taken the side of people experiencing injustice, and we're called to do the same. But how do we do that? Last autumn, the Methodist Church joined partners across the UK to launch their campaign, Let's End Poverty. It's a diverse and growing movement of people united for a vision where UK poverty can't stop people. But how do we share that information? How do we engage with political leaders? And at a time when there's possibly going to be another general election, the potential leaders, how do we engage with them and say, please tackle and end poverty? It's not right. As Christians, this is our priority for our community. What are you going to do about it? It'd be very interesting to see what responses we get. And that reminds me, one of the things that I noticed at the end of my walk around the city walls are the snooks. Has anybody been to York recently and seen the snooks? Well, how big are they? They're about huge, that big round blobby things with little antennae. That they're a model of a character, and different organisations have painted them and put a different turn on what they're about. And the one outside the art gallery is painted in rainbow colours, and they're all holding little books. And the book on the one at the art gallery, it says, this book is called Find Your Voice. It's a book about the art of protest. And that was really a nice ending to our little walk. Pure and spotless, let us be. God cares passionately about righting injustices. How do we respond? What is our act and protest? Love inspired the anger that cleared a temple court, overturned the wisdom which their greed had wrought. We'll now say together the words of Singing the Faith 702. And take that as a sort of commitment. I will speak out for those who have no voices.